Welcome, listeners, to a realm where shadows dance and whispers echo. I'm your host, Rick Clifton, and this is Quills and Chills, the podcast that brings you face-to-face with the masterminds behind the macabre. In each episode, we journey into the minds of horror writers and filmmakers to uncover the secrets lurking within their tales of terror. From classic tales to modern nightmares, we'll traverse the corridors of the human psyche and unravel the threads of dread that keep us turning the pages or sitting out there in the dark. Welcome to Quills and Chills. Hello, and welcome back to Quills and Chills. I'm your host, Rick Clifton, and today we are talking with author Lee Mendello. Lee is a writer, critic, and occasional editor whose fields of interest include speculative and queer fiction, and his work has been nominated for multiple awards, including the Nebula, the Lambda, or as we like to say over here, the Lammies, and also the Hugo Award. Today, Lee is here to talk about his latest book, The Woods All Black, which is available March 19th. So welcome to the show, Lee.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Before we get into the specifics of this amazing book, which I absolutely loved and could not put down, I want to get to know a little bit more about Lee. So can you just give us the obligatory, who are you, where do you come from, all of that good stuff?
Yes, the basic rundown. I'm a Kentucky author from Bullitt County. I am finishing a PhD in gender studies currently at the University of Kentucky, and also writing fiction as we go. I used to edit Strange Horizons magazine, which some folks will be familiar with if they're science fiction nerds, till about 2015. And since then, I've been working on novels, novellas, and a column at Tor.com's website on queer science fiction and film.
Fantastic. So I know you have another novel out, which I just picked up, but I haven't finished yet, is Summer Suns. It's described as a Southern Gothic. And you being from Kentucky yourself, I have to ask, does a lot of your work have a Southern bend to it?
I think so, yes. Or at least, we'll say two-thirds. We'll do that. Because the middle novella, Feed Them Silence, is up in the cold north because it really set the emotional tone for me. I don't like to be cold. But Summer Suns is kind of the semi-autobiographical, very personal Southern Gothic about queer masculinity and the ways that it appears in this kind of space in Appalachia and the South that is a little bit different. And I think we don't see it as much in texts and media in a way that I really wanted to explore. So I think I keep coming back to it because it's where I grew up. I have a lot of attachment to it and also have a lot of critiques for it, naturally, as someone who's come and gone from the space and loves it, hates it. It's complicated, you know.
Right. Right. As a lover of horror myself, I have to know, how did you come to this genre? What initially drew you to the horror genre, number one? And maybe number two, as a writer, do they correlate? Are they different?
So I do think I've been writing a little like an interview essay for a different thing I'm working on right now for this book, thinking about growing up in the 90s as a queer kid and how much horror there was and how if you were looking for any queer stories, they were mostly horror fiction in the 90s. And now as an adult who's done my queer history studying, it makes a great deal of sense that coming out of the 80s and into the 90s with politics the way they were, with the HIV/AIDS epidemic, that horror was a space where I think a lot of writers really felt able to get into the emotions and what it meant to survive in that way. And I do think we're coming back on a resurgence in queer horror, unsurprisingly, as we're having a resurgence of far-right politics and a lot of anti-gay, anti-queer, anti-trans mobilization everywhere. So I do think those are kind of connected on the fancy politics level, right? Using my degree here, but on the more emotional level, I like really intense emotions. That's the kind of art that I feel drawn to the most. And I think horror, erotica, and the melodrama are like the three big ones where you can really get at a lot of the intense bodily emotions and the feelings you might have about yourself and the world and how those relate in a way that readers really connect with. And I love to connect with as an audience member, right? Like on both sides of it, I'll watch a scary movie, read a really good unsettling book, and then think, oh, wow, how they do that effect. Like, I'm still carrying that. Just a little side kind of story about how some of this stuff continues to come back to you. I showed a pair of friends the original Blair Witch film because they just never seen it. And now it's a thing that we just sort of have in the background, right? Like, you know that existed, ooh, shaky cam, whatever. And they were simply not prepared for how intense of a viewing experience that was going to be. And I liked it way more now than I even did as a teenager, because I have more of an understanding of, like, oh, those are kids, like, filming this silly short documentary in the woods, and this is horrible. Whereas when I was a teenager, it was just exciting and scary. And I think that's nice, that you can keep coming back to horror differently as you age, even the same pieces.
That's so interesting to talk about Blair Witch, because I remember when I first came upon Blair Witch, for me, I didn't know the hit, I didn't know what it was at the time, right? So it was promoted, the marketing around it was that it's this found footage about these kids that got lost in the woods and sort of disappeared. And, you know, years later, we found their footage and this is what we see. And I was so drawn into it. And you know why? Is because I think, for me, I've done a lot of thinking about this over the years. What drew me to it was, growing up as a kid, I grew up in the South, like you. And in the South, we didn't have the city experience, or where I grew up, we didn't have the city experience. We didn't have the urban experience. We grew up in the woods. And so all of our experience was running around in the woods. And it just took me back to this time where, you know, getting lost in the woods and hearing these noises and all these experiences around you is very surreal at that point in time. So yeah. I could totally relate to that.
Yeah. Find an old house, you go in it, and who knows what happens. Like, realistically, we could have fallen through the floorboards, but, like, right. The movie really gives you something.
Well, and funny enough, my grandfather had a cabin that they used a lot when, I guess he was younger, but when I was growing up, it was, I wouldn't call it abandoned, but they would use it for hunting, I guess was the thing. I didn't hunt. I was not that kid. I was not that guy. But cousins and family members would use this place for hunting, and it was old and dilapidated. And it's exactly like you said, it's like, I wouldn't go up into the loft because I didn't want to fall through it, all this old rotted wood and everything. But we'd spent nights in that cabin, and like two, and in particular, I heard something walking on the front porch one night, and I haven't been back since. And to this day, I don't even know how many years that is, but I haven't been back since. So, which actually, funny enough, brings me to my next question. Were there any, for you, were there any specific experiences growing up that you would say influenced or drives your interest in horror today?
Yeah, it's something that the more you talk about, like, oh yeah, the things that were normal as a child growing up in Appalachia the South, it's like, I think I'm not very superstitious. Until you bring it up with someone who's actually not superstitious, for real though. And they're like, no, you have all of these weird little things. Like, you know, you hold your breath going by a graveyard, the blue glass bottle stuff. And it's that middle ground where I'm like, I'm not sure I believe in it all the way, but I grew up with it. It's all of these superstitions about death, largely. And the way that death is part of your life and that it's all around you in nature. You're in the woods a lot, you see a lot of that. And I think that really shapes you as a kid going forward into how you think about the way you interact with the natural world, for one thing. I know that there's a lot of, like, horror of place. I like to describe the woods, the smell, the space that you're in. And particularly when you move away and come back, I think that all comes kind of rushing back a little bit. So that's something that I've carried, I think, out of that childhood where you're wandering around in the woods a lot. And then secondarily, I did have, like, a great or great great, I'm honestly not sure, you know, aunt and uncle when I was a child had a very, very old farmhouse. And I remember wandering around it before they sold it and it was torn down to, you know, build a subdivision, and thinking I had seen a ghost. And maybe I did. I was a kid, so it's hard to say, but that was spooky, but not scary. It was just sort of like a confirmation to childhood me. It's like, I knew it could happen. And I think that's my big one from childhood.
That's great. That's fantastic. All right. Well, I know we're not here to talk about our childhood. We're actually here to talk about this really amazing book called The Woods All Black. So let's dive right in if we can. First, I'll start off with the question that you always get asked. Just give us a brief overview of what the book is about and maybe a little bit about what inspired you to write this particular story.
Yeah. So I think our tagline we've been going with this one is an interwar Appalachian historical horror, which is a mouthful, but it's set in 1929 in the eastern counties of Kentucky because, and this is real history, there was something called the Frontier Nursing Service, which drew from a lot of women who had gone away to war, become nurses, come back, didn't really have employment after World War I. And also there's simply no healthcare at that point in most of Kentucky. Unless you're in a major city, there was no access to doctors, vaccines, and there was a very high maternal mortality rate. At the same time we're hitting birth control becoming available, we're thinking about contraception, it's becoming a religious battle in the country. So there's all these kind of threads coming together, and a rich woman named Mary Breckenridge, who also, there's a lot of buildings at the University of Louisville named after the Breckenridges, they're still a rich family, put together a nursing service and was just sending folks out on horseback to go vaccinate people and deliver babies and try to fix these things and build hospitals. And the archives of some of the oral histories from the 30s of these people who had done this nursing service are at the University of Kentucky, where I study. So I sort of happened upon it by accident and then couldn't stop thinking about how complicated that sort of history is, because it's also the phase of eugenics, where a lot of this birth support and maternal support was also very much about supporting more white people having children explicitly. So I kind of wanted to dig into what would it be like for a character who had come back from the war, who is Les, who's very much an invert, a butch, he, him, it's a complicated gender space, and how reintegrating into an American life as fascism is really coming back on the fore could work. Sometimes better if you just have an excuse to be out on your horseback wearing trousers, doing nursing work, than it does if you're in Louisville, for example. And how that runs into the kind of prototypical trans masculinity or trans man you might meet, Stevie, the other protagonist, in these small town spaces, in the sort of sense of how we've always been around, there's always been something, and there's always been a lot of risk associated with that. So that was my general narrative, is what happens when those two collide in a religious small town with a bunch of spooky stuff going on.
I love that. I think one of my favorite aspects of this book is just how comfortable Leslie is with himself, how confident, how unwavering he is in who he is. And for me, that was especially impactful during a time in history, and as you write about quite well in the book, when, especially in small towns, being out can be extremely dangerous. Yeah. So I guess my question is, what inspired you to create this character who is, I think, in a lot of ways, probably before his time?
So part of it is that I really like that phase of history, and I think that we don't talk about it a lot from a specifically queer historical perspective, because it was a flourishing in Europe, in America, in the 20s, that interwar period. There were more queer writers, people out in public. There was a very broad sort of coming out socially. You could go to drag bars. It was popular for rich straight people to do. And there's a lot of very specific echoes, some of which are really frightening, honestly, to that sense of you can have a lot of progress and then it can go away very, very quickly. And I think there's a lot of echoes right now that I was feeling when I proposed this novella in 2020. And you'll notice it's coming out in 2024 because I had started working on it and then it was too emotionally difficult as COVID started and everything else. So I actually took a long break getting back to writing a character like Leslie and also a character like Stevie who are encountering this really head on. And I think when I initially proposed it, I was leaning more on the historical thematics, the these things are similar, how are we working through it? And then as I was writing it, it became way more sort of in the genre of the bash back story or rape revenge as like a genre trope in a way that I ended up finding really healing, I think, to be able to activate that rage that we're allowed to feel that way and we're allowed to want revenge and that's fine. And maybe they should have acted right. So I think it evolved in that way over time to be something a little bit more aggressive And I think that was the right choice in bringing this kind of character to the forefront. Because I think we expect to see bad endings in a way. And I don't even think that's a spoiler here, because I think I telegraph it with it being a bit of a romance from first page. It's not about a bad thing happening to these historical queers. It's them getting theirs, largely. And I really think that's an important thing to have right now, just generally speaking.
I would venture to say anyone that picks up this book, make sure you stay into the very last page. You will not regret it. You will not regret it. Let me just say that. Taking it just a step back from the character a little bit, probably did this a little out of order, but I got a little excited about Leslie. But this book is sort of described as a story. I've seen it described as a story of passion, of prejudice, and of power. But for me, it's also it's actually a story about living your truth, especially in the face of those prejudices, right? So without giving too much away, I guess, how would you describe this book? How would you describe your approach to, or the challenge of, looking at these traditional notions of religion and prejudice and sort of how they intersect? Intersect is probably not the right word there in this case, but still.
Come into conflict, maybe. Yeah, I mean, I think, so I grew up in a very rural part of Kentucky to a very religious, like, Pentecostal family. So I'm totally open that there is some me working through some stuff I'm still mad about in this book. Yeah,
we'll get to that.
But I just think it's really difficult, especially I think for younger readers, which is something that I'm kind of drawing out from Summer Suns and the audience who found it, a lot of them being younger in their late teens, early 20s, and having the experience of reading something where they got to feel like they could be mad and messy and also horny and gay, and it was fine, which is like not a message we get as much as there is sort of the generalized American propaganda that like, it's totally fine here. We're a really progressive, accepting country, which we all know is complete bullshit, but it is the story you get told, I think, as a queer person or as a kid, especially now. And then you're seeing the world. You're like, that's not right. That's not what I'm experiencing, is loving acceptance. That's not where we are.
Right.
And so much of that in the US is deeply Protestant, Christian, evangelical hatred. On every news channel you turn on, every direction you go, lots of fundraising groups putting forward anti-trans and anti-queer laws everywhere. Like, it is a constant battle against a very specific group. And I think that that way of dealing with religion, and particularly evangelical Christianity in the US, is something that was really important to me to get into, because I think it's a little bit disallowed still. Like, it's not polite, I guess, unpolite to say, like, fuck these people for what they are doing. And I think if you make it a historical, like, you can kind of pull people back a little for maybe their initial, I don't know about that reaction, to really see what's happening and see what these kinds of systemic structures are doing to queer and trans people. Even if it's not the preacher's hands directly doing it, then it's the whole community not doing anything to stop it. And I think that's something I really wanted to get into with the way that religion acts as a system of oppression in this text. So yeah.
And it is... it is absolutely something I responded to as well. And I think you may have answered this next question, but my question is, what for you, what was the most challenging aspect of writing this novel? And how did you overcome that? What did you, like, what was your process to sort of work through that and overcome it?
Yeah. So two-part on that one. I think, again, I proposed it in 2020, so I was thinking about reproductive justice, bodily autonomy, all that jazz. And then everything that's happened since in terms of the laws both made it more stressful. Like, I could not work for as long periods of time as I'm used to drafting on the really tense spots of the story. Or if I did work for a while, I would have to take a longer break to kind of get back together, go see friends, have a coffee, go out, watch a gay movie, something that feels good to come back to that, even knowing what I was going to do with the story by the end, right? Knowing everything's going to come together, you still have to write those things. And I think the sermons were actually the number one like thing where I was like, just wanted to peel my skin off. And some of them just really going back, you know, you're like, what did people talk? What did they talk like? Looking up like the Bible verses. I don't know. When I proposed it, I had not thought about the fact that that was part of the research I would have to do to get it right. And that was unpleasant. Like, I can totally own that. Like, oh yeah, it's just full of this stuff, huh? Ugh, and just having to go back and look things up. But I think healing that space while you're working on this, or generally, actually, I would say, does involve a lot of then going back out to community, because writing is so solitary that you're just in your head imagining this up, drafting it, crafting it to be as upsetting as humanly possible. And then you do kind of have to call up your friends and be like, okay, I need to go have a bowl of ramen. Like, we have to go do something else. Go to the gym, you know?
Get me out of this. Right. Yeah. Yes. Get me out of this. Exactly. Yeah. One of my favorite moments in the book, and this sort of ties back or relates to a little bit of what you're talking about here. And as I mentioned, there were a lot of trigger moments in this book for me. And especially in terms of religion and growing up in a small town in the country and what those experiences are. One of my absolute favorite moments in the book, and I hope this is not a spoiler, but it happens about halfway through, but it's when Leslie first stands up to the pastor, right? The build up to that moment, every single thing leading up to that moment had me so angry. I was like, I could just smack these people down. I was so angry. I was like, I just would like, and I was waiting for that absolute moment. And when Leslie did it, it was such a great sort of vindication. I was very, very excited for that. So to that point, I'd love to have you sort of talk about some of the other characters, such as the pastor. Are there any particular characters in this book that you felt a strong connection to or a strong hate for in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's probably obvious from page one that I absolutely hate the pastor. Like, he's the bad guy pretty resolutely. It's not hard to tell from page one on that. But I think some of, we'll say, the deeper cut characters include the family that Leslie is staying with, and particularly the wife, because I think it's something right now that people are really struggling with, thinking about how gendered and queerphobic violence can be enacted by cis women, and is a lot. But there's a sense where that, I think, comes up against people's understanding of like a feminist praxis or critique, where it's very difficult for them to approach the intersectionality of this, particularly straight folks, just generally, to understand that straight women are also very, very high on the hierarchy of power in our society. They aren't at the tippy top, but they're much higher up, particularly if they're white, than most other women and any queer person. And I think that's something that I really wanted to get at because of things like TERFs, and generally the ideology of radical feminism is very conservative, it's reactionary, it's deeply bioessentialist, and I thought it was important to not only have the obvious villain, right, of the deeply misogynist, horrible pastor, but also all of the cis straight women who are upholding the exact same system that we know as readers is not doing them any favors in any real way, but it's letting them have power over a couple of other people because they've bought into the system. And that's one of the little, like, it's a political theme, but it made the character interesting to write, because she's just so unpleasant. Like, not directly most of the time until the end, when she feels like she can be directly unpleasant. And it's how all those things sort of weave together. I also loved, of course, the granny, the auntie, because every community has that older woman who's mysteriously not married and maybe is a bit of a witch and lives on the edge of town. And she will always be very important to the kids who need her and need that kind of space. And so those two sort of different hands, right? You have the woman who is upholding all of these systems and the woman who is trying to make space where she's at. She's not going to leave. She's going to do what she can. And she can't do everything, but she's got a house you could go to. And I think those are both part of that small community in a way, where things can be very tense, but there are places to go sometimes.
In regards to Sarah, I was hoping she would come through in the end, and yet, not to give spoilers, how that ended up, I was like, well, I'm not surprised. I had hopes, I held out hope, but I'm not surprised. But I will say, I absolutely and particularly loved Marge. I thought she is exactly how you described. She is everyone's auntie. She is the house that you go to, the refuge when you just need a minute, right? And for me, she is every single one of my cousins. and so I would have to say, is there someone in your life that inspired some of the, or are there people in your life that inspired some of these characters?
Yeah, I think so. Particularly, interestingly, for Marge, like, that's more based on other people's, like, stories about the women that they had in their community, because I primarily ended up sort of in the, I moved out early in Kentucky space into, like, kind of just queer co-op crust punk housing. Yeah, so it was more like we made a little space, but there were older queer folks who other people knew who could give you advice, be like, well, here's how you go to here, here's the doctor you can see. Like, now it's a little easier to Google those things, but I found my first, like, primary care provider as a baby college student who was a gay man and had any idea about the kind of healthcare that I needed, like my hepatitis vaccines. And that was, like, information I wouldn't have gotten without elders in the community to share that information. So I think there's a really soft emotional spot for me about that. And now that I'm teaching and in my middle 30s, like, I think that's young. But when you have the baby teens, the queer teens, they think you're much older. It's like, oh no, now people are looking at me. Like, okay, all right, all right. And trying to grow into that space, I think. So it's past, present, future, thinking about the utility of people who can be there for you when you need it. Particularly, you know, as I've said, with the laws how they are right now, there's a really intense, I think, effort to block older queer folks from interacting with younger folks in a way that is, like, really clearly designed to cut off systems of support like that. So it's important. I just wanted to have it be part of the narrative because I've seen how beautiful it can be and how much it can support people. And I want to one day offer that space, hopefully, when I'm much older than mid-30s. I, you know.
Well, Leo would probably be categorized as your auntie in this case. So I can tell you there are, I guess, hierarchies, I guess, if you will. So from the beginning, when Leslie arrives in town, he senses something just under the surface in Spark Creek. There's a particularly, for me, a very particularly scary and pivotal moment. And perhaps this harkens back to what I was saying, you know, with when I heard something in the middle of the night in my grandfather's cabin. But there's this moment that happens when he's coming out from the outhouse in the middle of the night. So without, again, without giving too much away, without being spoilery, for me, that was a pivotal moment in the story. But I'm curious what you would say, or could you tease for us sort of a pivotal moment or a scene from the book that you feel like readers should look forward to when things take a turn? Because you take quite a few turns in this one.
I think that's one of the big ones plot-wise, for sure. Because you don't know what's about to happen, and it really shifts a lot of your perspectives on the characters who are in that scene in a way that the rest of the story draws from. We'll say that, carefully cutting around
the spoilers. Right.
But I think one of my favorites, broadly speaking, is probably, this is a little spoilery, but not really, the first sex scene in the book, I think, is at once supposed to be a really hot gay sex scene, but it's also them working out gender at the same time and how their respective different gender identities that people might perceive similarly, but aren't quite the same, can work together and how those things can cross, and also how physicality and sex can be a moment for real emotional tenderness too, even though it's very much like a sir boy, like there's some power dynamics, everyone's having a great time. But it's about care. And I think holding hands there between care, being alive, being in your body, and being allowed to have control over what you want done to your body is really important. And I thought it mattered to not fade to black with that, particularly in a story where sexual autonomy and gendered autonomy is such a big deal. It would feel like a bit of a cheat if I didn't show the happy, like the joyful, sexy parts of that too. So I had a lot of fun with that one. And also getting copy edits like from your editor on sex scenes is really funny because you're still getting edited. It's still like, was this the perfect word for this exact moment? It's very fun. So yeah, I think that'll be mine to look forward to for people.
I would kill to see those edit notes. But I will say the first sex scene that you talk about there, after coming out of it, I was like, wow. that was done on a level where it was both physical and emotional. And there were just all the, like, I had to take a moment. I had to take a breath. And I'm like, I don't know that I've ever read something or even seen something in a movie that felt, that I felt that dynamic. I don't know. Dynamic might, yeah, I think dynamic is the word. It was just, there was a lot, there was so much happening, like, in all of that. I thought it was really well done. It really left an impression on me. So great. Love it. Can't wait for y'all to read that.
So. Yeah.
There is, so horror is often, and we've talked a little bit about this in the beginning, it's often what we call, what I call an allegory for life, right? Is, and I think it's kind of clear, but I'm just kind of curious what you think your message or experience would be for your readers to take away from this book. Is there a specific impact or a meaning that you'd like to leave with them? I have a quote that had an impact on me, but I'm going to let you go first and I'll say it afterwards.
Okay. Yeah, I think with this one, it really is to embrace all of the things about yourself that a conservative culture, an anti-gay, anti-queer culture tells you are the worst and the most evil parts of what you are, but maybe actually they're the best parts of what you are, and that that isn't the measure you should be using. And I think particularly when it comes to sex and the erotic or how you intend to present your gender based on how you feel your gender, because those are two different things. There's room in between. Mm-hmm. That you don't have to take advice or take your rules from people who would rather you didn't exist at all. And I think that's the, how we came up with a tagline. It wasn't me. I think I'm borrowing it from Carl, my editor, that was like, they call you a monster, show your teeth. And I think that is also something, again, growing up Kentucky queer in the 90s, like I have a sense of rage that I will carry forever. And I think that it's good to externalize that sometimes in the proper directions and then make community with people who are also not part of that hegemonic straight life, even if they're not exactly the same as you. Like, we can all make a family together.
Exactly. That quote, by the way, is on the front of the book, and I absolutely love it. I think it's fantastic. The quote for me that really left an impact or an impression on me, and out of not wanting to be spoilery, I won't say who says it, but the quote is, maybe I'm just a boy with different parts. And when I read that, I put the book down and I had to get up and just take a walk for a second. I was like, what a line. I mean, it's just so important and amazing. It was really, really great.
It is fun to write a T for T romance in a sense also. And this is, a friend said this, and now it's all that I think about other taglines for the book, that just for the listeners, maybe don't say it if you're not in the space, but it's the dyke for fag, like, romance of it all. Like, that's what's going on, is these very resistant gendered ways of being. Like, no, this is what I am and who I am, and you can deal with it. Like, this is what it is. And now that makes me feel little hearts everywhere when I think about it. Like,
that's,
yeah,
great.
It's what it is.
So I want to take a second to sort of reference something in your acknowledgments that you did in the book, because I think, as we've talked about and as you've mentioned quite a few times, I think it's important to highlight these things whenever possible. You acknowledge drawing inspiration from a wealth of novels and poems, and many of which were written by queer writers and is about queer life and published in the late 20s and the early 30s. And I think it's absolutely important that we acknowledge and seek out our queer history right now, because especially these days and everything that's going on in the world, we're seeing a resurgence of you know, history is repeating, as they often like to say. And I just thought it was really great. And I just wanted to, it's not a question, it's really just more about, I wanted to say thank you for doing that.
I mean, especially I think for younger readers, that was why I put the list in at the end, because that was so important to me. Like, being a teenager looking for anything at all to read. And some of what you found were the obvious, like, read the picture of Dorian Gray, right? Like, you see it, that's what you get. And I think that was so important to me, understanding what queerness could be outside of myself too. It helped me be me, but also to see how other people were doing it and had done it through time, or across the globe. I watch a lot of like Thai gay TV right now because it's way better than ours. And it gives you those other perspectives like, oh, there's more expansive ways to do this. We've been doing it and inventing it and going back and reading things like Marcel Proust. That's who I borrowed the title from. It's a line from Swan's Way. Like, yes, I'm a nerd, but I think everyone should read a little Proust. I think it will make them feel better. It locked in time in a way.
So to sort of lighten things up, being mindful of our time, I'm going to ask probably the obligatory question that you get asked in every interview, but it is absolutely a question that I just love because it inspires other pieces for me. But who are you reading right now?
Yes. Okay. So my favorite book last year, because I'm lucky I just did my like best of 2023, whatever, like 4 days ago. So was Walking Practice. It's a South Korean novel by Dol Ki Min, who Victoria Cottle translated it in English. It is loosely, I will say, about a shape-shifting alien who ends up on Earth and has to eat people to survive. But it's very much about disability and queerness because this alien's body like can't function in Earth gravity the right way, quote unquote. So you get a lot of scenes of trying to get up a staircase, carrying a backpack, and how brutalizing that is if your joints don't work right. So you're thinking about all that. And then of course, fucking and eating people. And like all of that's going on in there too. And it ends up being this kind of beautiful, upsetting way of exploring how we love each other as queer people and also don't, and like how we're not there for each other sometimes and the risk of being in the world. It just lit me up. Like it was a whole new way of thinking about science fiction that I hadn't seen for a while, and I loved it. And then also Sam J. Miller is a favorite. I've been editing a short story collection that comes out from Erewhon in 2025 now, and just finished editing Sam's story, so he's fresh in my mind also. The Blade Between is excellent, we'll say a gentrification gothic, I think, about the Hudson River area. Yeah, that is very much about queer masculinity, but also resisting gentrification and neighborhood renewal. And like, what if gentrification is like a haunting, like an evil one? And I thought that was delightful. So those are two big ones right now.
All right, cool. So what's next on the horizon for you? What else are you working on?
Yeah. Oh, I just have
that you can talk to us about.
Yeah. Didn't give the title, but the title of the anthology that I'm editing is Amplitudes, Stories of Queer and Trans Futurity. I think we should be announcing the table of contents by the end of this month because it's done. So I know what it is, but I think we'll be announcing it soon. I'll say that. And some other theoretical things on the fire that cannot be mentioned yet, but hopefully soon.
All right. Perfect. Well, yeah. We're standing by. Very, very excited for all of those. Last bonus question, not related to the book. It's just a question I ask everyone. I want you to write a short horror story on the fly right now using only 3 random words.
Okay. Okay. I'm looking around my room now. I'm going to steal some words. That's... Your rice cooker goes off, but you didn't set it, and it smells a little off, maybe like meat.
So what's for dinner is the words.
Yeah. Why is that? It. Maybe it's just an electrical fire.
I love it. All right. So the book is called The Woods All Black. It is available on March 19th. As we always like to say here, please, please support your local bookstores. And Lee, can I ask, how can our audience find you on social?
Yes, I am on all the major platforms, Twitter, I refuse to call it X, who does, Instagram, and now Blue Sky, just as Lee Mandello, super easy.
That's perfect. Thank you so much for talking to us today. I really appreciate you being here. And everyone, that's it. We'll see you next time on Quills and Chills. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me on another episode of Quills and Chills. I hope you enjoyed our deep dive into the mysterious and the haunted. If you're enjoying the show, don't forget to support us by subscribing on your preferred podcast platform and leaving us a rating or review. Because your feedback helps keep those chills running down both our spines. and feel free to share the show with your favorite fellow horror enthusiasts. Also, if you guys have any spooky stories, strange encounters, or paranormal experiences of your own, I'd love to hear them. Reach out to me on social media or email me at quillsandchillspodcast@gmail.com. Who knows? Your story might end up on a very special episode. Anyway, thanks for listening, and I will see you back here next time on Quills and Chills. Bye, y'all.